This is Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs program, airing Tuesdays at 6 p.m. and Saturdays at 10 a.m. I'm Gavin Dahl. On this week's show, we hear highlights from the first two episodes of Wildish, a new podcast from High Country News, launched to coincide with the nonprofit news magazine's 50th anniversary. The focus of Wildish is federal Mustang management in the not-so-wild West. Host Anna Colburn introduces us to wildlife managers, landowners, wild horse advocates, and staffers from the Bureau of Land Management. If they can't work together on solutions, the Wild Horse and Burrow program could soon reach a breaking point. From birth control administered by DART to the family dynamics of wild horses on the range, there's plenty to learn. Stay tuned.
Wildish is a story about the humans tangled in the world of wild horse management. Activists aching for the animals to be wild, those who see them as invasive, and the people with the Bureau of Land Management faced with balancing the horse as a relic of Wild West heritage along with its impact on the landscape. From High Country News, in collaboration with Alan Wardas Media, I'm Anna Coburn, and this is Wildish. The population in Colorado alone is supposed to grow up to 7 million people by 2040. But outside of the office buildings and the houses and the tourist attractions, the West is still wild. It's jagged and it's beautiful. There are long stretches of highway without any cell phone service. There are places you don't want to get lost. And the elements, they're always out to get you. The West I'm talking about is from Colorado to California, from Montana to Arizona, from New Mexico to Oregon. And it has its own set of unique problems. And one of the biggest headaches, if you ask people who know about it, is the issue of wild horses and wild donkeys, or burros in Spanish, that live out here on the range. For a master's project last summer, I traveled all over the West to talk to different people about wild horses and burros and ask them why it's a problem and what we can do about it. Now, if you didn't know anything about wild horses, you're not alone. I didn't either. In fact, my only education about wild horses was from the movie Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron from DreamWorks that came out in 2002 when I was a kid. You know, the one where Matt Damon narrates it and the horse has perfectly shaped eyebrows. But it's all really fascinating. We've had wild horses and burros here in the United States since the Spanish conquistadors came over. They were everywhere. But like the story of most things in the American West, their numbers began to dwindle. It literally took an act of Congress to get these wild horses and burros protected in 1971. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, was tasked to manage these horses and burros. The BLM set a carrying capacity number, or limit, to 27,000 animals across the West. But now we are long past that threshold. In Nevada by itself today, there are 45,000 of them. Across roughly 10 states, there are upwards of 100,000. So what do you do with all those horses and burros? You gather them up off of the rangelands. And the most effective way to do it, according to the BLM, is by helicopter. And a lot of people really don't like that.
They've made helicopter contractors multimillionaires two dozen times over, and seem bent on these very dangerous and harmful ways to manage wild horses.
That's Ginger Catherines. She's the founder and executive director of the Cloud Foundation, a wild horse advocacy group based out of Colorado Springs, Colorado.
BLM has never embraced humane management of wild horses. They think it's too hard.
Tracy Scott, the co-founder of Steadfast Steeds, a Mustang sanctuary outside of Grand Junction, Colorado, tells us what happens next.
After horses are gathered from the ranges, they are offered for public adoption. And if there are horses that go to the public adoption right off the range and they are not adopted, they go to what's called short-term holding. And a short-term holding facility is dirt lots. They're predominantly in the 10 western states where the horses live on the ranges. They are all separated from their families into mares in age-appropriate pens, geldings, because the stallions are castrated when they come off the ranges. It's mandated in the law. And so gelding pens sorted by ages. And then the babies are all gone, go into a baby pen. That's short-term holding. Once they've been in the short-term holding facility and been passed up for adoption three times, or they're over the age of seven, I believe, and they haven't been adopted yet, they go to long-term holding, which is in the Midwest. And the pastures are fence-to-fence grass, which is not what their bodies are used to. All boys in pastures and all girls in pastures. They don't get to be families ever again. And that's what the holding facilities offer them, which is kind of base, it's a base existence. It's not the way a wild horse would want to live its life.
Several years ago, the BLM asked the National Research Council Committee to look at the Wild Horse and Burro program. The National Academy of Sciences published a modest 384-page report, at least the version I have, on their findings. Here are a few sentences from that report. Adoption demand does not balance the number of animals removed, and there is no political support for culling unadopted animals. Therefore, BLM pays for animals removed from the range to live in long-term holding pastures for the remainder of their lives. This was published in 2013. In the fiscal year of 2019, $57 million went into feeding and taking care of these horses and burros in these holding facilities. That's well over half the program's $80 million budget. For 2021, they're getting $116 million. That's an insane amount of money. And of course, it's coming from taxpayers. That's your money. That's my money. There are around 50,000 horses and donkeys in these holding facilities. Ask any horse person or donkey person, just one is a lot. So obviously, this is not a sustainable plan. We can't keep, as I've heard it quoted, storing the horses and donkeys in these holding facilities. It's way too expensive. So why not leave them alone? It's what some activists want. I joined a couple of wild horse activist Facebook groups, and man, do a couple of them hate the government. One lady I follow consistently posts that the BLM are tyrannical, evil, sadistic maniacs. Though the National Academy of Sciences report criticizes the BLM and how their carrying capacity numbers aren't really backed by science, it does say leaving the animals alone to be wild isn't what we should do either. Quote, the consequences of simply letting horse populations, which increase at a mean annual rate approaching 20%, expand to the level of self-limitation, bringing suffering and death due to disease, dehydration, and starvation accompanied by degradation of the land, are also unacceptable. End quote. In conclusion, we have wild horses and burros that live in the western United States, and the program put in place to manage their numbers is, well, it's a mess. And you're probably starting to think poorly of the people who run this program, but I'm here to remind you that people are people, and they get up, and they drink their coffee, and they put on their uniform, and they go to work.
Many days I walk into work and have no idea what my day will yield.
And they know how much they are hated.
Obviously, this program is, I mean, of all of BLM's programs that BLM manages and oversees, this is probably one of the most politically sensitive programs in the Bureau from the public's perspective. There's a lot of opinions.
I've been speaking to Bruce Rittenhouse for the past 2 years. He's the acting division chief of the Wild Horse and Burro program in Washington, D.C. I've always appreciated his honesty and willingness to talk to me, even from the very beginning when I thought this subject would be easy to talk about. It's not. It's a world where nobody really likes anybody.
There's the advocate side and the activist side who don't support anything we do, to those groups that are real strong partners with us, and others who are on the other side of the coin and want us to aggressively more manage more, but they have no idea about what the daily life is in the program.
That's really important. I wanted to talk to people with their boots in the sagebrush, people who experience wild horses and burros on a daily basis, whether it's working for the program, taking pictures, being an advocate, ranching, adopting, whatever it is, I wanted to talk to those people. I didn't want to talk to people who fall for anything they see on Facebook and get outraged.
I mean, there's so much misinformation out there. There's a lot of information that gets put on the internet that is not cross-referenced or corroborated by or cross-checked. You know, we don't violate the law. We don't break the law. I mean, so we're doing it all under our policies and regulations and the statutes. So, you know, I just think it's that kind of thing when they accuse you of things like that. And one of the things I always try to tell myself in the job is that I can't be emotional. It seems like we have a lot of people that I think they actually, you know, hope for bad things to happen just so they can witness it, and which will then help them drive donations for their program. A few horses on a gather that's ongoing right now, just this past weekend and late last week, the horses were coming into the trap, and about six or seven horses kind of veered off and broke a fence, ran through a barbed wire fence. Of course, and then I get to work this morning and there's like 15 emails from people and, you know, claiming the horror and the you know, the atrocities that we've done. And, you know, the horses were all safe. They were all removed. They had, you know, we had a veterinarian check them, you know, so they see that, but they don't see the full story. And, you know, they talk about our brutal gathers, you know, helicopter gathers where thousands of horses die. I mean, you know, a lot of horses die. And, you know, so I mean, and that's not even near the truth.
But there's always room for change. We have to hold our systems accountable. And if you go down the right rabbit holes, the BLM has done some really sketchy things.
I know the BLM has made, I would say, several mistakes in this program. When we do have to do population control, we remove them in the what we feel is the most humane manner possible. That when they come into our care, we try to place them into good homes. And if they don't get placed into good homes, we care for them for the rest of their lives at taxpayer expense, granted. And I make that clear, that because some people say you feed 48,000 horses. I said, yes, we do, at about the tune of $50 to $60 million a year. But it is a very emotional issue. There's that, you know, tie between horses and humans that have been through our history of humanity. And, you know, it's interesting. They, you know, a lot of the advocates don't really have that same emotional link with, you know, domestic horses in some ways, race horses. I mean, you know, the racing industry is more brutal than we would ever think of being.
But we need advocacy in every situation. We need people who are passionate, who aren't afraid to stick it to the man. But in the BLM's defense, I can understand how frustrating it can be when it feels like everything you do will be attacked. When your hands are tied and it's all up to the people in Washington, D.C. to make these decisions. I used to be a park ranger, and sometimes getting a new stapler in the office seemed like an act of legislation itself. So what do you do when no one's really right and no one's really wrong either? Across the board, across the spectrum, everyone can agree that the way that we manage wild horses and burros needs to change. It's emotional because just like we love our dogs, we love our horses and our donkeys. We can't forget the donkeys. These animals have evolved with us over time, and in the United States, the wild ones represent a heritage. I think who says it best is David Phillips, the author of Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. This was the first book I read when I started researching this issue. Dave is also a reporter for the New York Times. He researched this topic for years. Dave said something really cool when I asked him about the relationship between wild horses and American history.
More than any animal, I think the wild horse or the Mustang embodies what Americans think of as their own story. Technically, the animal that represents America is the bald eagle, but that's really a symbol of federal power. It's aloof, it's regal, it is not necessarily the rest of us. But the wild horse is an immigrant, like all of us, or nearly all of us, and the wild horse has no pedigree. It has no special breeding. It is not of the gentry. You know, like most of us or our ancestors who came here, it came with very little and made what it has out of you know, just being able to survive with what's given. That's a really powerful idea in the United States, you know, that it has freedom because it earned it, not because it was given any title or had an important lineage. That's the American story, that we are all here and we can make it, you know, if we have the smarts and the toughness. And so in a real way, as America sort of made itself and told stories to itself about what it was, the wild horse emerged as a kind of mascot. If you think about it, the cowboy is maybe the other most American character. The cowboy's best friend and closest ally is always the wild horse. The cowboy never rides a fancy thoroughbred. He always rides some horse that he got off the range, and usually it's a horse that would only submit to him because he was noble. So there's this idea, and it's a very democratic American idea. We will submit only to the deserving, you know, that we have a government and a society that is just and moral, and that is why we are part of it. But at any point, we totally maintain our fierce independence, and we could run off back onto the prairies, you know. But the wild horse is the blood and bone symbol of that idea, that we submit to living in this just society, even though at heart we are liberated and free.
When Dave initially told me this, it made a lot of sense because it fits with the most typically told American story of pioneers and manifest destiny, but that's only one part of American history. To some people, wild horses don't mean anything. They're not a symbol. They're not part of their heritage. To some people, the American story is completely different. In our next episode, we will talk about what it is about wild horses that we find so enticing. And what is life like for a wild horse out on the range? That's next time.
The horse was put together with different aspects. The mane and the tail are considered rein, and then the frog of the hoof is an arrowhead, which is protection in our culture.
Everybody wants their history to be understood and passed on and respected, and trying to figure out how to balance everybody's history with one another is incredibly challenging.
Even the name wild is controversial because they're feral. That's a domesticated species.
Don't. Because we are going home in this very second. And you came here for nothing.
It's fine. I'll just drive 5 hours for nothing.
The first time I saw wild horses, I was in the Sandwash Basin of northwestern Colorado. It's over 150,000 acres of vast, open country. There are over 50 miles of very bumpy roads. And nearly 800 wild horses.
Oh my gosh. Before I get there, I always like to know who they are before I get there. Oh, there's another one over here.
From High Country News, in collaboration with Alan Wardas Media, this is Wildish.
They're gorgeous. Maybe I need to get pictures of them. They're just having fun.
The voice you hear is Patty Mosby. She's an advocate for the Sandwash Basin. She takes beautiful pictures of these horses. I also want to say saying Sandwash Basin is really hard, so I might just stick to Sandwash. I reached out to Patty, and she offered to show me around the Sandwash without me even having to ask. So we met early in the morning, and I climbed in her truck. I wasn't even sure if we would see wild horses, and if we did, I figured we would have to use our binoculars. But to my surprise, and less than an hour into our adventure, they were right by the road.
Now, you see this stallion? He'll put his head down and his ears back and follows the mares. That's called snaking. That's because he wants them to move. He wants them to move up the hill.
Wild horses don't just stand around and eat, although that'd be a pretty sweet life. They have a complex and competitive social structure.
So if you look at the roan's left ear, he's lost the tip of it. Uh-huh. That's significant when we're trying to ID him. The little snip on his nose, and he's got he probably got it bit off.
Tracy Scott from our previous episode, the co-founder of Steadfast Steeds, explained to me how the families work.
In the wild, there's a lead stallion and a lead mare, and then there's family members. Usually there's some other mares or other girls that are having babies with the stallion. But the lead mare, her role is safety. She makes sure that the family is safe. She leads them to water. She leads them to the best nibbles of grass. And she lets them know it's time to go, regardless of what reason it's time to go, because they all trust her to take them to safety. The stallion, the lead stallion of the group, his job is procreation and protection. He has the right to breed the mares in his group, and he gets tough and shows the other horses, the other girl horses, that he's a tough enough guy to protect them. And so they decide to go with that particular stallion or a different stallion based on how well or how safe they feel when they're with him or in his presence. So he's looking for a way to show off and make sure that he can be the safest stallion to be with, and the girls decide.
Seeing it in person, though, that was awesome, because I saw them fight and I saw them mate, and I was just right there. I could walk up to them. It was crazy.
Oh, come on. You guys can't come any closer. Nope. Anna's just overwhelmed. She just can't even believe it.
As well as being a photographer, Patty is also a volunteer for the BLM. She goes out and she darts the horses with birth control.
The first time we dart a horse, we dart her with a what we call a primer dose. It's a stronger dose. We use an air gun to shoot the darts. Those are shot from an average of 40 yards. And the dart, as soon as the dart hits the mare, there's a charge inside of it that ignites. And it then ejects the PCB into the mare and pushes the dart back out of the mare so that that doesn't stay in her. At which time, we make every attempt to find the dart in the field and recover those. So after the mare's been primed, we have to wait at least 2 weeks. Then we come back and we want to give her a booster. Preferably, we want to give her a booster within the same year. And what that booster does, it just kind of wakens up what you did with the primer. So we do need to be darting year-round. And we do dart in Samwash Basin year-round if we can get into the basin.
PZP, and that's a Z in the middle, as in zebra, stands for porcine zona pellucida. I butchered that. Someone knows how to say it correctly. But for our purposes, we'll say the PZP vaccine.
PZP is made up from using pig ovaries. Those are ground up and mashed up, and then they use an adjuvant to deliver that into the horse.
So great. That solves the overpopulation problem. We can just start them with PZP and stop rounding them up via helicopter, and the controversy is over. Right? Of course not. I wouldn't be doing a podcast if it was that simple. We're only on the second episode. If you didn't catch how meticulous it is from what Patty had described earlier, then go back and listen. You not only have to keep up with the mares that you've darted, you have to dart them twice, you have to be good at shooting a dart gun, and you have to do this year after year. Most of the people who do this are volunteers. They're not getting paid for it. They do it because they have the time and because they love the horses. There isn't enough time, money, or resources for this to be a viable solution. In fact, the BLM wants to start spaying in the field to cut long-term costs. That's something we'll talk about later on in the series. Now, you're probably wondering why they don't just, you know, snip-snip the stallions. But the way it's been described to me is you can't catch all of the stallions, and those that are still intact are going to, quote, cover the rest of the mares. So it doesn't really work. It's hard, having ovaries. Patty kept pulling out an Excel spreadsheet of all the horses she had already darted and all the horses she had yet to dart. She knew their bands and their babies. And a useful tool to keep up with the horses is to name them. And that seems perfectly natural because they're horses. But if they're wild, why would we do that? We don't go up to an elk herd and name elk Jeff and Starburst. But unlike elk, horses are distinctive. They look different. They have different breeds. And they have this thing about capturing our hearts.
That's why she deserved a nicer name, I think. She would have deserved a nicer name.
What would you have named her?
I don't know, but I would have looked up something, a Native American, because she really is exceptionally beautiful.
I met Otilia the same day I was with Patty in the sand wash. Otilia is a friend of Patty's and a fellow wild horse photographer. Patty told me Otilia didn't like people, and that's why she hangs out with horses all the time. So I kept my distance because I had a microphone, and that's kind of intimidating. Okay, actually, I was really intimidated by Otilia. But after a while, we started cracking each other up. The next day, we went to the first day of the Great American Horse Drive together. The Great American Horse Drive happens every year. It starts right around the Sand Wash and eventually goes through the town of Maybell, Colorado. We put up our camp chairs in a pretty good spot, close enough for her to get great pictures and me to get great audio, until a lady told us, maybe not right there. Reluctantly, we moved, and sure enough... A few hundred ranch horses being herded by cowpoke almost ran us over.
Could you believe we were... Thank you so much.
I've been obsessed with horses since I was a little girl. I grew up riding them. I grew up drawing them and pretending I was one in the school hallway. I was that weird kid. So hearing Otilia's story made me angry. It made me sad. And I was thinking, well, these people just don't like horses.
How come that they end up being shot, chased by four-wheelers, or kids throwing stones, rocks, apples, or treats at them, and it's okay? They should be out there and do their jobs, not just from the office.
They being the BLM. I had to know the other side. I had to know why the BLM seemed callous and negligent. But maybe it's because our ideas of management vary from person to person. So why not ask a wildlife biologist? Why not ask someone who really knows about wildlife management?
Do we manage them like a wild animal? Where again, you know, we have hunting seasons and nuisance trapping and things like that for wild species when the population gets too big. Do we manage them like livestock then? They're really not livestock either because at the moment they're not domestic. They fall between the cracks, but one thing that we have to remember, there's a huge cultural significance to the horse. Our human culture evolved with the domestication of the horse.
I want to thank everyone who participated in this episode. And Otilia, if you're listening, thanks for trusting me with your stories. In addition to talking to a wildlife biologist, in the next episode of Wildish, we will talk to an Australian native about brumbies and a senior extension agent at the Navajo Department of Agriculture. That's all next time. Thanks for listening. All the music in Wildish was written and performed by me. Thanks, Mike, for letting me borrow your guitar. The series Wildish was made possible by Alan Wardas Media, Brigham Young University's Charles Redd Center, Western Colorado University's Graduate Studies and Master in Environmental Management Program, the Margie and John Haley Fund, and Dr. Corey Knapp. A big thank you to High Country News for publishing Wildish, and you for listening. Please rate Wildish wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to highlights from the first two episodes of Wildish, a new podcast from High Country News, launched to coincide with the nonprofit news magazine's 50th anniversary. Founded in Lander, Wyoming in 1970, the publication relocated to Paonia in 1983 under the leadership of Ed and Betsy Marston. On our website, kvnf.org, you can hear my interview with HCN's new publisher, Greg Hanscom, about the evolution of their staff model to include a broader range of perspectives across the West, including more native voices. This is Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. Thanks for listening.